This is the Retro Computing Roundtable, episode 45, recorded Sunday, February 17th, 2013. No matter where I go, there's one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? I may not be a Carrington Vanston, but I play one on TV. And I'm also going to play host for this episode. And scooched up to the round table with me are the usual scoochers, David Grealish and Earl Evans. Hello, scoochers.
Hey there.
Hey.
How you guys doing?
Good. I'm doing very good today. I'll answer up.
He had to think about it.
No, I'm doing great today. Having a really beautiful day outside, so the sun came back out. Little weather chat, you know. So it's been inside most of the day, but it's a really nice day out.
I'm a pale nerd, so for me it's always a beautiful day inside. What about
you,
Earl?
Yeah, I got the hacker's tan too.
And
I'm
how's life in Earl Land?
Exceptionally well today. I'm very, very alert, and you know, it's almost like I'm really living here. So
almost. Well, we are going to try out something in this show that David came up with and introduced in the last episode, and we'll see if we can sort of find our way to how to integrate this, and it's the host's topic. The idea is that in addition to the regular news shows, we're going to have a topic of interest that we sort of discuss, something about a computer, something about software, that sort of thing. We're sort of finding our footwork in this, and I have decided as the host that my host topic that we're going to discuss now is going to be our first computers versus our real first computers. Here's what I mean. For me, my actual first quote-unquote computer would be an Altair 8800. I had that as a partially assembled beast that I then put together and played with. And it was great, and it was awesome. It was also something I could barely do anything with. No way to save anything, but it introduced me to the idea of having a computer. That was great. I then had, I think, a Heathkit. I think I had a Kim one. I had a couple of then more put together computers, and I started to get vague on what order. But then I had the Apple II Plus. And for me, that was the real first computer I had, something I could understand, something I could really use, something I fell in love with. And it's because of the Apple II Plus that I became an actual computer user. I became a programmer. I became the nerd that I am today. So for me, there was a real difference between the actual first, literally the first computer I had, but then the computer I think of as my spiritual first computer. And I'd like to know if it's the same thing with you guys. So I'd like to ask you both, what was your actual physical first, the literal first computer you ever had or had access to? And then what would you consider the spiritual first one, the one that got you hooked, the one that is your, you know, emotional first? So David, let's start with you. What was your very, very first computer?
Well, my story's similar to yours, though you got started sooner than I.
Because I'm old. So
my first computer was a Commodore 64, and it was actually a computer I really wanted, and I was a very poor college student, and couldn't.
Oh, so not till college.
Yeah,
oh, really? Wow. So you didn't have a computer until college? Like not one in your house, not one with your family or anything?
No.
Okay.
Well, I'm a little older than you, actually.
And so the dinosaurs, as they roam the earth.
But I actually had a very nice girlfriend that bought me a Commodore 64 for my birthday.
You should still be with her.
1985, so kind of late even with the Commodore – not too late with the Commodore 64. But all I ever had was the Commodore 64, nothing else. So I had it connected to a television set, and so all I could do was like do some real basic programming and leave it on for days at a time.
Okay, so similar like me with the Altair, yeah. Where I didn't have a means of saving, I didn't have anything. Like you were in the same position.
And I would have liked to have done more with it, and it could have become my first platform, if you will. But a real quick story then is, so I was on my own. I was an adult at that time. And for one time in my entire life, I had my own apartment shortly after that, my own little one-bedroom apartment. And I had just moved in, hadn't lived there 2 weeks, and had very little furniture, and I had my little 13-inch color TV on the floor and my Commodore 64, and I was messing with it, and I had like a glass sliding door, and I didn't have any curtains on it. And like a dummy, I went to work. I was a waiter and worked at night. I left it on. I should have just turned the TV off, right? I don't know why, but I left it on, so it's glowing, and my neighbors have this big party. So I come home, like I worked at Bennigan's, if you guys remember that. I came home like at 2 o'clock in the morning, and someone smashed in my glass sliding door, and took two of my most, you know, only valuable things I really owned. The other, my car, I guess, was the computer and the TV.
Oh, that's awful.
So, yeah, so that was pretty sad. But anyway, shortly after that, I went to work for a computer store, and that's where I discovered the Macintosh. And so from that point on, I was like all about, I'm going to own a Macintosh, where it was even more expensive. So it wasn't until December.
But your first Mac wasn't a real Mac, was it? I think it was a Lisa
right.
or something, right?
It was a Lisa. Yep, from Sun Remarketing. So it was a new old stock Lisa that they had upgraded to where it was essentially a Mac Plus. So that was December 1989, and it was cheaper than what a Mac Plus was. So that's why I went for it. So it was $1,099.
So you would say that the Commodore 64 was your literal first computer, but the Macintosh right. platform was really your sort of
Absolutely.
Emotional first one.
Oh yeah, and that machine, I used a credit card to buy it, and I needed to also make me some money, so that's where I first got into desktop publishing, and I used to do resumes for people and stuff like that, and earn money back.
For me, it was the same sort of thing. The reason I wanted to get into computers and how I funded my first purchases was at the time the taxes had changed here in Canada, and people were having a lot of trouble changing their cash registers. And so I walked up and down Yonge Street. I had a budget that I needed to buy my computer. So I walked up and down Yonge Street as this young kid. But it was a time where everybody thought, oh, young kids, therefore are computer whizzes, whatever. Nobody really understood anything. So they had these all programmable cash registers. And I walked in with a fake little, well, fake, but printed business card just saying that, you know, I'm in the business of making that. I had no idea how to do it. I just knew it needed to be changed. And I took $100 deposits. And it was a $200 service that I would change over their cash register. I took $100 deposit and scheduled a time for me or one of the other technicians to come back. And I did that until I had enough $100 deposits to buy myself the computer I wanted. And I said, okay, now I guess I better learn cash register.
And then you skipped town.
And then I went back and did it all again. I thought, oh my God. And that was it. I got into the idea of, holy crap, people will pay you to do stuff like this. And then I just became an independent programmer and stuff, going, thinking I can actually sell this as a service, not doing cash registers anymore, but indie programming and stuff. So that's how I got into it. So what about you, Earl?
That's cool.
What would you consider, what was your first actual computer that you or your family would have had?
Now, are we talking about computers at home or computers we had access to?
Anything you want.
Because the first microcomputer that I had access to was at my middle school, which at the time we called junior high, and that was an Apple II. It was one of the original Apple IIs.
Oh, so not a Plus or anything, an actual Apple II.
The situation as I remember it was that our school could submit these Fortran batch jobs to the mainframe downtown. It would take 2 days to get your program turned around, and all of that wasn't very interactive. Our instructor owned an Apple II of his own and decided that he wanted to bring it in for the enterprising computer students in his class to use and learn on, which I thought was just a fantastic show of commitment to his students. So he brought in his Apple II, and we learned how to program on it. And when I saw it and I, you know, found out, wow, this is a computer and you can actually sit down and do things on it. You don't have to wait, you know, for your stuff to turn around. It was like love at first sight. So, but this was a limited scenario in many ways. We didn't have a disk drive. It was just cassette storage. The cassette storage wasn't all that reliable, so you're always biting your fingernails wondering if your program was going to get lost. And obviously, I didn't have access to it at home or anything like that. The first computer that I had access at home was when I went to work for a computer store called HW Computers, and one of their policies was, if you're a salesperson there, they would let you take home your choice of the models that they had in stock so that you could learn about and become expert.
Wow, pretty nice.
One of the systems. Oh, it's a
good benefit.
Yeah, great benefit.
That's a reason to take that job.
No kidding, huh? So the one that I chose was an Atari 800 and an 810 disk drive and, nice AMDEC color monitor. And that's really what I feel like is my first computer that I could do anything practical with, because I had a disk drive, I could load and save my programs, I had access to the various software packages that we had for demo purposes at the store, and that's probably what I would think of as my first home computer. It wasn't the first one I owned, but it was the first one that I could really grapple with.
And what was the first computer you actually owned, like when you actually purchased one?
That was a VIC-20. Got it on the employee discount. It was cheap already, and when you buy it on the discount, it's even cheaper. And that was the first one that I had any kind of ownership of.
So why'd you go for the VIC rather than sticking with the Atari world?
That's what I was going to ask.
Well, price. And it would have been a good question, David.
price was definitely a factor. Even with the discounts that we had as employees, a full Atari system would have been out of my budget at the time. The second mm-hmm. thing is that I had some affinity for the Commodore systems because in high school, and I think I've talked about this before, I used the Commodore PET with the chiclet keyboard because nobody else wanted to mess with that chiclet keyboard. They hated it. But I'm thinking this is free computer time, and I was voraciously hungry for computer time. So I'd already kind of had some exposure to Commodore and the funny graphics keys and all that kind of thing. So when the VIC-20 came out and I looked at it, I was like, oh, wow, I know this. I'm familiar with this. This feels good. So it was a combination of the two things. I think mostly price, though. A friend of mine, Eric, he and I had started the local Commodore Club there in L.A., and he'd come to me just, his eyes were glowing one day practically, and he said, there's a computer we can afford now. We can actually buy this thing. I was like, what is it? And he told me all about the VIC-20, got me excited about it too.
It's amazing how that still is the case today. I mean, computers are expensive things, but you hear less or at least fewer stories about that sort of idea. Like somebody just gets amazed at the idea that, oh my gosh, there is now a system of some sort that I can actually have. Because especially with things like the iPad and that kind of stuff nowadays, there's computers that range huge price ranges and use systems. You can always pick up a computer that's 5 years old and get it quite cheap. So, but there wasn't, you know, the computer that was 5 years old if you were shopping for something in 1980.
Yeah, and that's funny you bring up the iPad because that's what I was just thinking. Is you know, I just caught a commercial the first time I ever saw. Have you guys seen this new commercial by Amazon where now they just barely caught it? I think we were in a restaurant maybe or something, and they show the iPad and they show its display, and then they show the Kindle Fire and its display, and they're showing you how, oh, see, it's not much different, right? And they show a few things like that. Then ultimately the point is they show $499, $299. On the Kindle Fire, and I'm like, you know what? That pretty much says it all right there. That's good. That's pretty smart advertising on their part.
Sure, I mean, absolutely. It's a huge advantage.
Most people might know that, but yeah, I wonder if the same thing's going on with you know, tablets.
I think that was so. The same thing, and there's a huge difference. I mean, like you could get a Nexus 7, which has become a really popular tablet mm-hmm. for the $200 price range, mm-hmm. and
yeah.
that's just a gigantic, you know, chasm between people who can afford $200 for a tablet and people who can
$500
drop five bills.
Five or up.
Right.
But,
sure,
Earl, the same thing for me was, you know, I worked at an Apple dealer, and even at a discount, I have this written down, like, in my book, in my story, but so I think I'm remembering correctly, but I think it was $1,800 for a Mac Plus. And come on, you have to have a hard drive. Even in 1989, it'd be ridiculous not to have a hard drive, right? So it was like $1,800 for the Mac Plus with the hard drive under it, 20 megabyte, you know, at a discount. And I had no hope of affording that. So I was able to get my Lisa for $1,100. That was huge, you know, the difference.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, I find it an interesting topic. So I've talked to a lot of people. I'm always interested in somebody's first computer and whether that mm-hmm. computer is still sort of their platform of choice. The way that I'm a complete Apple zealot, and I can totally trace that back to that first Apple II Plus I had. And well, it was,
I think it's true,
I don't know,
for
my
all
fourth
three of
or fifth computer. I guess so. Yeah, like it definitely is the case for me that was the computer that I truly fell in love with. I loved computers as in general. I had loved access to computers I had at home, the ones that I had at school, like Earl. I also had access to a PET with a terrible chiclet keyboard in I guess that was junior high or something. But it was my Apple II Plus was my first actual, you know, real computer that I owned. That one was through my parents' money partially. And just fell in love with the platform in a way that I hadn't fallen in love with the other ones specifically. I was just more in love with computers in general. But it was the Apple that turned me – and then I became that whole, you know, that guy that I am – the zealot that I am today. I remain. So, but I've always
– that's why I became
– yeah, it's just I've always thought of it as there's a difference between the actual first computer and then my, you know, my real love first computer. And there was a difference. So for me, I just was interested to see if it was the same for you guys. But anyway,
that's true
we should
– Earl, I'm because you're a big Commodore guy, I think, at heart, Earl is, and I'm definitely a Mac person mm-hmm. at heart. That's my first love or whatever.
And I have love for, like, before the show, before we started recording, Earl and I were talking about, in fact, the Atari 800. And I was talking about the form factor for that. And I adore, I've always had this crazy, crazy warmth in my heart for the Atari 800, which is bizarre since it's a computer I have barely used at all. But it's just something about the form factor for that that I just draws me. And I'm sure that I will one day spend a lot of time on that platform. But for me, it's been Apple all the way since that early 2+ days. So anyway, that was our host topic. Now let's get into some news, guys. It's time for news. The news is new, and David is going to kick us off. David, you're going to kick us off with Project Genesis, which, if I recall, is something out of a Star Trek movie.
Yeah, wasn't it? What was it called? The Genesis device?
Something
maybe?
Like that? So is that now real? Should I be worried? Are you terraforming
the
Earth?
Spock back to life, right. And then it spawned Star Trek 3, I think.
And really, really ticked off the Klingons, so I'd be careful if I were you.
Everything ticks off the Klingons.
Well, that's true.
My daughter, who's become a huge Star Trek fan, is like yelling at me from the living room about something about no, Dad, because he's hearing what I'm saying. I'm on the air, hon. Basically, this came out, I think, on the same day we did the show, 2 weeks ago, is what it says. So, just real quick, is Project Genesis is a little short film. How long is it? I think it's like a little over 6 minutes. Have both of you guys seen this?
No.
Oh, watch it. It's very entertaining. It's very cool.
Okay, so we'll be back in 6 minutes after this break.
it's about Macintoshes as people, essentially.
Sure, we had talked about this.
Apple computers.
We had talked about this before.
I think we saw a promo for didn't we?
Yeah, exactly. So he released it, and it's well done. It's a very nice little film, and so basically, Apple computers, created man. That's all I need to say about it. No spoilers, anything. So go watch it.
I believe that's revisionist history.
I'm pretty sure it is. Yes. Well, Guy Kawasaki had that thing. Wasn't it him? The Macintosh Bible? Wasn't that written by him?
He did the Way, the Macintosh Way.
Oh, yeah. So there was something called the Macintosh Bible. So maybe in that, and in the beginning, Macintosh created man. Let there be electricity. So, Earl, next
See
up will be you. And David, maybe while Earl talks to us about the SBC 6120, you can take a glance into the comments and see if anybody else has been discussing their first computers and stuff. I'd be interested to see what the commenters have to say about that. But Earl, first up, what about you? What is this SBC 6120, that whole bunch of letters and digits? Is it a license plate? That's my guess.
It is many numbers and letters, isn't it? But actually, it's also a very fun project put together by Spare Time Gizmos, and this particular kit has been around for quite a long time, and they're very popular. When they come out, they sell out really fast, and there was a question mark whether or not this kit would ever be available again, and it turns out that the person who created it said, hey, I've got some of these parts still available, and I'm going to do another run. So he did a Kickstarter, and they're $600 a piece. So in terms of the kit, where this would fit into, economically, this is among the more expensive kits. So first let me tell you what it is. It is a single board computer implementation of the DEC PDP-8. It's a replica sort of kit. It's based on the Harris, I think it's the HD 6120 chip, mm-hmm. which was a PDP-8 on a chip. And you take that chip and you build a computer around it, a single board computer. It also comes with this really nicely laid out front panel with the LED blinking lights and the rocker switches. Think IMSI, but miniaturized.
Right, and it's gorgeous looking.
It
Very
really
authentic
is
looking.
Beautiful, and the coloring reminiscent of the DEC equipment at that time. So I've actually seen one of these in person at the Seattle Club meeting, loved it, thought it was a gorgeous computer. Steve Gibson of the Security Now podcast is very fond of these, has a couple of them showing in the background whenever he does his podcast. And apparently there have been hundreds of these that have been made over time. And so, again, the question mark was, would there ever be another run? So there was. It was a Kickstarter project. It got funded well ahead of schedule. Mm-hmm. All 30 of them got bought up. And this, apparently, because of the parts availability, this is it. This is the last batch.
And while we'll link to the Kickstarter, and it did get funding, and it has 6 days to go, you're still SOL because there were just 30 available, and all 30 have been taken.
That's right. There were 30. The 30 are gone, which, you know, I think is neat, and I'm excited. I hope that some of the people who purchased them will blog about their construction experience, and that because different people have mounted these slightly differently and have done different things with them. Steve Gibson, the guy I referenced, even did a little bit of hacking on the boot firmware so that he could have some programs that ran right when you turn it on so that you could do some different dances with the LEDs using the toggle switches and that kind of thing. So it just looks really neat. And for PDP-8,
and it is about the mounting, like you say, because it's a single board, and the FP stands for front panel. So it really is a board on this front panel, and that's the combination. The board works on its own too, but he said that nobody ever buys it without the front panel. But then that's all you have. Like, just so you have to put it in or mount it on some sort of case or something. And in the same way that what differentiates the various Apple ones, it's sort of like what kind of case you put it in, like what you do from there. Do you make something out of wood or mount it? So it'll be really interesting to see what people do with theirs. So they assemble this to get it working. What do you do? Do you mount it on the wall? Do you make a case? Do you put it in something else? I really hope that the people that did this will blog about it. I'd love it to be documented.
Yep.
I actually thought it came with the frame, but I just read and noticed that it doesn't. So you do have to add that.
You do. And Steve Gibson put his in a nice Aaron Brothers custom frame. It was a black sort of color, and it looked gorgeous. And I've seen other implementations of it that were really artistic as well. So, and there's a lot of PDP-8 enthusiasts out there. And, of course, a number of PDP-8s themselves that are still working. Like the March group has a couple of them, and I've seen one up at the Living Computer Museum in Seattle. But they're very expensive these days. It used to be you could get one kind of on the cheap, but no longer. They go for thousands now on eBay. So anyway, that's that project. I thought it was cool, and hope even that I'll be able to get Bob, the creator of this, on a podcast episode. We've had a couple emails go back and forth, and hopefully we'll be able to carve out a time to chat.
That'd be good. Also, if you talk to him, or when you talk to him next, Earl, would you ask him about, does he have any plans on re-releasing, updating his other kit, which was the Cosmac Elf?
The Cosmac, it is
2000.
It's one of the topics that we emailed back and forth on when we were talking about the podcast. So,
because I could only think that he would, I don't know how many he sold, how well it did, but I would only think it could do better now.
Yeah, well, again, that would depend on availability of the RCA, what was it, the 1802 chip that went in there? And I think I've seen those on eBay available, so I think you could probably source some of those chips, but I don't know what other components are in that kit. That kit is a little simpler.
Look.
It's, you know, that single board sort of scenario. It looks almost like the MicroKim. Actually, in its construction.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have one.
You have one of the Cosmac?
Yeah, I actually built it at the only VCF I ever went to in California in 2006. And so,
the same time
very
that
cool.
You did your replica
one. Yeah, I signed up for both of those.
Nice, so. Very nice. Can you show that on the show and tell sometime? Because I'd love to see that.
I'd love to see it as well. Absolutely.
I have to go. It's in a box out in the garage.
Go get it.
But yeah, I can get it.
Yeah. Yeah. You go right now, mister.
Very cool. So, David, before we get to the next bit of news about Sega, I'm interested in how are the comments going? Has anybody else commented on the topics we've talked about so far? Either this bit of news or about their first computers and that sort of thing.
Hit
me.
So Randall Kindig, Randy, said that his first computer was just after he graduated from college, and it was a TRS-80 Model 1, the base system, 4K RAM, 4K ROM.
That's enough.
But then he went on to get his first real computer, and it was an Atari 800.
Oh, nice.
What a great machine.
That's a major step up, too, in processing ability.
Yeah, that's what I said. It was a nice upgrade.
Mm-hmm.
And then KH KeySynth 75, anyway, not his real name. My first computer was an Amstrad CPC 464 and had it for years. So that tells us where, he or she may be.
Yep.
And those were nice machines, too.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great first one.
And then Christopher Just said his first machine was the Timex Sinclair 1000, and the spiritual first was the C64. And
I bet you it's a C64 for a lot of people. I bet you that was a lot of people's introduction to like a fully mm-hmm. featured computer that you can easily attach a smart hard drive to and that kind of stuff. I bet you that's the spiritual one for a lot of people.
Between 16 CPC, and 25 though, million, huh?
I'm jealous that he or she had an Amstrad CPC, though, the last commenter. Mm. Like, that's such a unique form factor. Like, that's such a unique first computer. Like, that's fantastic. I love that form factor.
Grumpier Than Now had at school, used a Bell & Howell Apple II Plus.
Oh, nice. Went the black one, the Darth Vader Apple II. Very cool.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, one last comment, and I'll hand it back over. So Christopher just said, I have nightmares about membrane keyboards to this day. By the Timex Sinclair 1000.
I had one of those. I had a ZX81, I think. Was really the only membrane computer I personally owned. But yeah, what a nightmare of a tiny. And the thing is, yeah. With that one, I had a printer that went with it. That was one of those little printers that just took a tiny spool of paper. It was like a cash register printer. I'd print out stuff on that, and
right.
So tiny. And then I had a similar printer that used the little rolls of paper for my Coco. I had a Tandy Coco, and I had one of those. And the Coco was something I did quite a bit of programming on. So I used to print out my my programs on that thing, and it was like little colored pens, and they would go down and would write everything.
Yeah.
So slow, but also little tiny printouts. So I have my cash register printouts of my program.
Well, and the Timex or the Sinclair ones, weren't they sort of that silver coated paper?
Yeah, the one I had for the Sinclair was almost like fax paper. Like it was, think it was thermal.
But it was kind of silvery?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it was bizarre. And they would fade. Like with the Timex one I had, if you came back to your printouts like 2 months later, the paper would be blank. It was like the world's worst printer. It was just so hilariously terrible. Yeah. I remember doing an essay once for the Coco and printing out my essay on that little paper stuff. And my teacher was just like, no, get a typewriter. So I had to retype it all in a typewriter. Yeah. So, yeah, early computing, the things you just don't do anymore. So my tiny little printers. So anyway, let's get back to the news. So Sega is in the news again, at least in the news in Japan. And this seems to be, as far as I can tell, a real thing that's coming by the end of the month. Sega is going to be releasing some retro gaming-inspired laptops called the Sega Note. It'll be a series of four different laptops, and there's four different covers. And at first I thought it was, you know, each laptop had one cover, but it turns out there's simply four ranges of specs you can get for the laptop, and then there's four covers you can choose from, or you can buy the set of all four covers and swap them around. So they're very similar to, I don't know if you guys remember, there used to be an Apple PowerBook, I can't remember the name, and it had a cover that you could slide an image into. Do you remember that
one? The 1400.
Was it 1400? Okay. So that's sort of idea, except these are printed covers. So you've got a cover that clicks onto your notebook. And the high-end specs will be, you know, pretty decent for a laptop. There's Core i7 Intel chip, 8 gigs of RAM. It's got an NVIDIA GeForce GT 650M, which I think is the 1 gig video card, 120 gig SSD, Blu-ray burner. So that's really their high-end. And they go down from there. But what's exciting about these is that the covers are based on old Sega video game systems. So there's the Mega Drive. You can get one that's inspired by the Sega Saturn, the Sega Dreamcast, and also just one that is simply the Sega game console. So if you're a fan of old Sega game consoles, if you grew up with the Dreamcast or you have fond memories of the Saturn, that kind of stuff, and you're a PC gamer, these run Windows 8, then it might be something to consider. I don't have any word yet on pricing, but unfortunately, because most of the news I can find out about is on Japanese sites.
Well, I just added one. I just added in the show notes. I just added an article from IGN,
which
collaborates this. It's saying that it's a collaboration between Sega and Ebten or whatever. What's that other site? The retailer. They're a Japanese retailer.
Okay, I do know that these apparently will not be sold outside of Japan. So you'll have to either go to Japan to get one. Earl, you're going to Japan soon. You can pick up one of these. Or you'll have to find a different way.
If they're going to be
way by them. July. Sure, they're coming out end of March, it looks like when they'll be released. So I found it really interesting that just you got this nostalgia wave still building. With the Saturn and the Dreamcast, a lot of people fondly remembering those systems. And that you can now get brand new laptops that harken back directly to those systems. So David,
in the IGN article, it says it's very limited editions, about 50 of each.
Wow.
With the low end at about $1,077, the high end at about $2,098.
Okay, so that's not outrageous pricing for these kind of specs, but that is seriously limited.
Also, I think it'd be, if since Sega is really
bother?
Involved in it, I'm sure their value would increase.
But how do you make a laptop run with such limited quantities? This must be a standard stock laptop that they're simply designing. They're going to print this many covers to snap onto it.
That's what it must
There's
be.
No way somebody's doing a full laptop run of only that quantity. You couldn't possibly do it.
And they might be doing something custom, you know, under the keyboard or something, but probably.
Yeah. There's nothing really fancy about the laptop. It's a chunky notebook. It's nothing super fancy about it. It looks like any old Windows laptop. So it's really just the cover that separates it. So it must be just that they're doing this run of covers to specifically snap onto a particular model. So maybe it's just something where you just have to get the covers. It's not the sort of thing that you couldn't emulate yourself or create a cover for. A lot of people use laser machines to etch into notebook covers and tablets and stuff nowadays. But I just found it really interesting that I've always had a soft spot for the Saturn in particular.
They do what? What do they do?
Etch. Have you seen etching? Oh, Google is your friend. You will find lots of examples of people using little laser etchers to etch images into their laptops. Oh, fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing designs. Really, really
awesome. Mostly a lot of MacBooks.
Yeah.
A lot into the MacBooks.
Yeah, David, right. It's very much MacBooks centered because you've got the aluminum or magnesium nowadays, or is it still aluminum? I never know.
Yeah,
it's all
aluminum.
Yeah, so it's easy to etch into them. You just got to make sure you don't burn all the way through. But some really intricate and really beautiful things. A lot of times integrating the Apple logo if they're doing stuff on the top of it. So really beautiful stuff. So anyway, I just found it really interesting that Sega's making a comeback. I would rather buy a new Saturn, but maybe this is the next.
Well, even though it's not a kit, I mean, it's not a reproduction per se, but it's up there with the same sort of things, like the PDP-8 or the making a reproduction Altair. You know what I mean? It's it's reproducing the experience, I guess, in a new form factor.
And if you're looking for a Windows notebook anyway, and I don't think these prices are outrageous, so if you were in the market for around that time in April to be picking up a new Windows 8 notebook and these are the specs you're looking for, if it's not going to cost you a huge premium and you're a big fan of old Sega systems, at least I want people to be aware that it might be an option. It does, of course, also involve a flight to Japan. But other than that, it's no problem.
We have to make sure and look and see after people get these Japanese people, perhaps, when they show up on eBay, maybe. You know,
oh, I'm sure that they will.
People might turn right around and resell them.
Yeah, and no doubt at a much higher price point. With that kind of limited quantity, these things will immediately go on eBay for a premium, unfortunately.
Right.
So, David, next up, you have selected not just one or two or three, but four different short news things you want to do all at once. Hogging the show, David, hogging the show. You are not the host. I'm going to pick one of these notes. So hit me.
Hit me with your quick mentions. Well, and they're all quick. I had these notes, you know, that I wanted to, you know, I built up and wanted to make sure to kind of put them in the show, but I didn't want to put, you know, four different things. So they're all really quick. So first, I want to read the email that we got from Terry Stewart.
Hello, Terry.
One of our big fans. And he spoke about, let me get there. Where's his email? Okay. So he'd written us about smoking caps, you know, capacitors and all that. And he said, enjoyed watching the show live for a change. Usually that's impossible here in New Zealand as it's Monday morning and all of us Kiwis are at work. Luckily, I'm on vacation and today it was raining. So I guess he's not watching now because I haven't seen him in there. But he talked about the caps that blew in my TRS-80 Model 3. They are sure to be filter caps on the AC line in the PSU. These old wax paper type ones, pre-1983 or so, always seem to blow, and in a most spectacular fashion, which was true.
Which is
I've
the
had
best
them
way.
Go in my BBC, Osborne 1, K-Pro 2, Lisa 2, Epson QX10, probably some others I've forgotten about. They smoke well. However, they don't seem to be critical, as in most cases the machine will just keep going with the blown ones. And he added a little bit more, but that's the gist of it. So that was interesting. I wanted to make sure to read that.
And Terry would know.
Mm-hmm.
He's a knowledgeable fellow.
Which he goes by Tez.
Yes.
And he has some great YouTube videos.
Oh, he has some great YouTube videos. Yes, we'll make sure we link to them. He's fantastic.
Also, a quick mention that Mike Willigal, who runs the Apple One Registry website, and he has made the Apple One reproductions, some of them. I guess there might have been at least another person doing them. But he is now working on a Selby reproduction, and he has a video up showing the first time he's powered up one of these. And so that's pretty neat. If you don't know what a Selby is, it was one of the few sort of non-microprocessor-based personal computer kits, microcomputer kits, you know, before the Altair. Mm-hmm. It's like 73, 74, along with the Mark 8.
With odd spelling for those who want it, it's S-C-E-L-B-I for Selby.
Mm-hmm. Another quick mention is from our fan and who's in the forum and watching us right now, Randy Kindig. Randy, I'm saying that right, I hope. And so he has a new podcast called Floppy Days, and he had emailed out and mentioned it's not, he's sent it to YouTube, iTunes. It's not there yet, but here's a link to it in Lisbon. So check out Floppy Days. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet.
Yeah, just got the one episode up so far, but absolutely. And great, mm-hmm. great title. I'm surprised nobody's used that before. Like, that's a really good title.
That's very cool. I think I remember him talking about starting that up over on the Vintage Computer forums. So
yeah, right.
Awesome.
He was talking about it.
Always exciting. I love the fact that there's more. There's so much room for more podcasts about retro computing, and there's definitely room in my podcast rotation for more of them. So I'm always really excited when new ones launch.
Very cool.
And lastly, not retro computer related, but Bruce Damer, who runs the DigiBarn, and he's a friend of the show, been on the show one time, and he started his own podcast, so he let me know this, and I just thought I'd pass it along. Mm-hmm. It's called Dr. Bruce's Levity Zone.
And I misread it for some reason. Instead of Damer
so check that
Banner,
out.
I was like, Dr. Bruce Banner?
Oh,
like,
right.
Like, it's just a whole thing. I totally didn't understand at first, but it was finally clear when I looked at the site. So yes, is over at drbruce.org.
And you can look up one of the older RCRs, and he was on it, and I could look mm-hmm. it up, I guess. But it's one of the, I think it's before 10, somewhere in there, he was on the show. But if you don't know about the DigiBarn, it's a computer museum, and I'm not sure its status currently, but he's been very involved with, like, the VCF in California and the Computer History Museum and things like that, and interviewed a lot of interesting people mm-hmm. and so on. So that's it.
Good mentions, all four, I say. So, Earl, what about you? Want to round out our news section with something about the Commodore?
I'll do it. We typically, we drop talking about all of the auctions that we mentioned on the show and how they did the next mm-hmm. week, because sometimes that's just boring. But I thought this one was pretty exciting. We were speculating what that Commodore 65 prototype would go for, and I think our guesses were a little on the high side. It wound up selling for
$7,600.
And then almost immediately afterwards, wow. I saw a posting on the Vintage Computer forums where somebody had said, well, my car died, and so I'm going to have to sell my Commodore 65. And
wow, that's crazy that you have two that quickly.
Just that, and yeah. put it up as a buy it now for $6,000, and it went immediately.
Right.
So I guess
you can imagine, because somebody would have bid just under $7,625 for the other one. They
right.
probably thought, oh, excellent. I was looking for one of these anyway, and so yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
how many are there?
There's just a few dozen are out there in existence, if I understand it right. And they're in varying degrees of functionality. Like, mm-hmm. I think both of these were
really varying degrees of non-functionality.
Yeah, both of these were non-functional units, but they're unobtainium in the Commodore world, so this
Absolutely.
Is... it's kind of exciting. So I guess we can figure the market price for a good condition Commodore 65 is $6,000 to $8,000.
I honestly think a big part of the collective, you guys might think I'm crazy here, but I think a big part of the collectability of the Commodore 65 is the name. Commodore 64 is one of the most famous brands in computing. And the fact that it's the 65, instead of the 128, which really came down, it makes it so clear what this thing is. I think from a branding standpoint, it has really helped its collectability. If this was called the something else, if this was the Commodore 350 XL or something, I don't think it would get this big of a buy. I think it's the 65 really promotes
it. I'm really surprised, though, that it really is that collectible or that sought after, that much money, when it doesn't work. That's surprising to me. It really is that much money. But it's all relative. I mean, if $7,000 to $8,000 isn't that much money to you, then
It's a lot of money to me. But
yeah,
I'm just saying.
But that's interesting. But I'm glad. So you think there's a couple dozen of them. I wondered, like, years ago when I ever first heard of a Commodore 65, first off, I thought it was like, you know, no one had ever really seen one sort of a thing, and then maybe one or two of them out there.
No, I think that there was an effort to get a registry going of them or something like that to figure out how many Commodore 65s there were, but I don't remember what the ultimate guess was.
And that's a good topic, is that, you know, like that Apple I registry. We need more of those kind of things.
Yes, we do.
Registries.
I agree. Absolutely.
There's a pet registry, so if you guys have a Commodore pet, definitely get out and register it on the pet registry.
Absolutely.
And you got one, Earl?
A Commodore pet, yes.
You have a pet? Okay.
I have one.
Okay.
Yep.
Did you get it spay and neutered?
40 leading publications love to excel. He asks the questions, you push buttons to answer.
Giraffes are the only animals that make no sound, true or false. True.
A uniquely educational toy.
Correct. The next time you hear nothing, a giraffe might be coming.
Plays any 8-track cartridges. Teenagers love him. Adults can't resist him.
2, 4, 6, 8. This is the way we lose weight.
2XL, now 36 tapes for all age groups by Mego.
Mom, Alfie says I got it right. Look, butterfly begins with a B.
I'm so proud of you.
You get more out of the play school years with Alfie, your child's first computer, with his own way of teaching spelling, math, even colors.
I got it right. I'm so proud of you.
Feeling good about the play school years.
Now what?
Well, now, we are going to talk about the retro computing gift idea. As host, I have selected a gift. And while I talk about that, David, I'd like you to dip back into the comments and take a look to see if people have comments about the news that we've talked about so far. But up next, the retro gift, the thing that I'm selecting as a gift. And I usually pick gifts that I would like people to purchase for me. And what I would like people to purchase for me is the Alan Turing Monopoly set. So Bletchley Park has officially launched this. It's in pre-order. It's based on an original Monopoly board that had been hand-drawn by William Newman, who was the son of Turing's mentor, Max, and that they played together when William was a kid, and William actually won. And it's a special, so it says basically it's Monopoly, just like you meant, but it's a special edition version. So the squares around the board are revised, the chance and community chest cards talk about elements from Alan Turing's life, the instead of being houses and hotels, it's huts and blocks, which were the buildings that housed the Bletchley Park codebreakers. So I find that really interesting. And Turing's face is on all the banknotes, so it puts him on the £10 note, which corresponds to the petition that's going on in the UK right now to try to get that done in real life. So I found it really interesting. I'm a big fan of Turing and not a big fan of how, unfortunately, things turned out for him. Real shame, real tragedy.
Yes.
But great if you're into this sort of thing. Like if somebody's a gamer and you're into vintage computers, or you have a friend into vintage computers and you want to pick them up a game, here's something really unique that you're not going to be able to walk into a store and find. Everybody already knows how to play Monopoly, but if you're going to play it anyway, why not play Turing Monopoly, I say.
I agree, and I wonder if the purchase of this actually helps with the funding for Bletchley Park.
I would assume so, because it is due Bletchley Park, and we'll have a link at bletchleypark.org.uk, and it's only £30. So for a special, very limited edition Monopoly board, that's not that much money. Like, you'd think that's the kind of thing that might have ridiculously gone for, you know, £99 or something insane.
Right.
So pre-order right now. I think it's coming up very shortly. You can also add a donation to Bletchley Park when you make the purchase. So, yeah. Anyway, that is my choice. So we'll have a link. This will go into our ongoing retro computing gift guide, which, of course, is over at rcrpodcast.com/gift guide, or just head to rcrpodcast.com and click on gift guide. So before we get to more things to purchase through the eBay auctions, David, tell me, what the masses,
what are they
the
saying?
angry masses, what are they saying on YouTube right now?
Well, let me just add too, because I looked it up, the Monopoly game. So if we wanted to buy it, that is U.S. or Canadian residents, it would be, it's £8 shipping, so it's about 59, well, I didn't look up Canadian dollars, but it's like 59 U.S. dollars.
Canadian dollars is slightly more powerful than your weak U.S. peso.
The extra comments we had was Andy Collins had come in and said the ZX printer used a narrow reel of paper that was aluminum coated. When printing, it passed a current through the alley, burning it away, revealing the aluminum, I guess, burning it away, revealing a black layer beneath. So that's how it printed.
Oh, interesting.
So that's pretty neat, yeah. And then Randy Kindig had said the 800 was a fabulous machine. I eventually moved on to an 800 XL and stuck with Atari when I moved to the
RESD. I don't like the XL as much. The XL is like a better computer, but I don't like the look of it. And for me, like so much about these old computers is the industrial design. And that original 800, like I never really liked the 400, mostly because of the keyboard. But that 800 and its keyboard and the little flip-up thing, which I only found out from Earl that turns off the power when you lift it up. I didn't even know that. That's how little I know about the 800. But I love the original 800. I just adore that form factor.
I didn't know that about that door. That's kind of like... Hey, come look at my new Atari. You know, I was
well, I was telling Earl I'd be programming and think, do I have BASIC in there? The ROM? Let me just check.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
But I guess it was a good idea because so you wouldn't yank them out.
The purpose was so that you wouldn't go swapping out the cartridges while the power was on, which destroys both the computer and the cartridge. But,
right.
Do you happen to remember like when it was new? Did it maybe have a sticker there that said "lifting cover turns machine off" or anything like
oh,
that?
Oh, you only have to do that once.
never saw that. Yeah, that's right. That's a lesson you learned.
But you know, the Atari 800 and the Apple II, I think, are very similar looks and everything about them.
They are similar sort of color, similar sort of keyboard. Mm-hmm. And that's a keyboard that I really like. That rounded keyboard from that period of the 80s. I just love it. Whereas the XL has a nice keyboard. Like, I really do like the keyboard. But Atari, by the time the XL came out, was into that sort of blacker look with the silver stuff on the sides and just didn't appeal to me quite as much.
Didn't feel as good. Yeah. They felt kind of wobbly compared to the
better
the
than
nice
those later angled
buttons
they had on the top of other machines. But the original 800, I think, is just one of the most beautiful computers ever. I adore, and I love the drive shapes, the little hexagon sort of drive shapes that in the little mini printer that you get beside it. The whole thing, I think, is just gorgeous. One of the most beautiful computers ever. Love it. Love it.
I liked all those keyboards. You know, the Lisa keyboard and then the original Mac keyboards were very similar, too.
Yes.
And I always really liked the feel of those keyboards. You know, a lot of people go on about the early, you know, PC keyboard. And which...
Sure, I've got
Model M's were awesome.
Yeah, I've got two Model M's, one of which I use as my primary keyboard on my Mac through a little adapter. Mm. Love it.
Oh,
yeah.
That
I love my
clicky
keyboard.
Is great.
It is.
And remember,
yeah.
You can still buy those. I think that might even be on our gift guide, the Unicomp.
Yeah, I think
yes, it
is.
Buckling yeah, of course, everything's in our gift guide. So, speaking of things you can buy, nice segue, Earl, let's look at eBay or other auction sites and see what the three of us have selected for stuff to lay down some hard-earned cash, maybe even American money. So, David, what have you selected?
Oh, I found something very interesting this time around. And first off, so it's an Atari Stacy 2, which, you know, I don't know a lot about the Atari Stacy, but I really didn't know there was a 2, an Atari Stacy 2. So, So basically, and Earl, you might be able to correct me. So I think this is a portable Atari 5 ST, basically, right? 520 ST.
I don't know much about the Stacy.
I think that's why they're calling it a Stacy. So obviously, I didn't research it that much before picking this, but I know that they're fairly rare. It's got, as of right now, 5 days left. It's about $224. It's got a buy it now of $550.
So if it's still going to buy it now, but it's got bidder, so I guess it's got a reserve then?
Oh, reserve not met.
Okay.
Yep, so far. So it's got a lot of good pictures. It says the hard drive isn't initializing, isn't working, but it does have pictures of, you know, using diskettes, shows the gym environment and all that. TOS.
Well, that is a very unique computer. I didn't know there was a Stacy 2.
Yeah, well, like I say, me either. I know I'd heard of this Stacy, and again, sort of like the 65, I thought it was pretty rare and, you know, seen in the wild and so on. But we'll see how it does. I'm sure I bet you it'll get the, you know, the reserve, whatever it is, $500.
And it comes with
probably.
A programmer's dongle, it says.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. And what about you, Earl? What have you selected?
Well, I went Atari also. Mine's a little bit more pedestrian than David's pick, but... The thing that I liked about this auction is if you wanted an Atari 8-bit computer complete with everything you'd need to just plug in and go, then this auction would be for you. It's a 800XL, a 1050
I was just talking about that.
Disk drive.
I was just talking about how I don't like it.
Yeah, well, yeah. a 1027 printer. Now, it's interesting, too, a Commodore 1701 monitor. It's not an Atari monitor.
That still works, though. You just plug them in. That's a good monitor.
Yeah, but the 1701, 1702, you know, those were darn good monitors.
Mm-hmm.
And this even has covers. It's got joysticks. You know, it's got these nice Atari-branded covers on it. And it's obviously functioning. I mean, the picture that they have here, you know, one of my pet peeves is people who sell the computers, and they go, I don't know if it works or not.
You know? I don't know how to test it. I'm like, you don't have a television you can plug this into? Come on.
Exactly.
Untested means tested to not work.
Plug into wall and turn on.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a nice looking system as far as like everything matching up and just looks very
robust. I would say the XL did look like a more professional. It looked like a business computer, you know, like something you could, yes, I am a professional business person and I am firing people every day or something. So you'd have that with your XL.
And here, that the XL, the 1050 and the 1027, those are all same era. So if you're talking about look and feel, they all match. The only odd man out here is the Commodore monitor.
I like the cover, the dust covers in particular. Very cool.
Yeah.
Really.
So anyway, and the price seemed reasonable for all of that, for a working, and when I looked at the pictures, the close-ups, it looked like everything was in good shape. So no bids at the moment, but it just, this auction just started 6 days, 19 hours left. $129 opening, or you can do the buy it now for $200, and the shipping was $99, which isn't bad when you consider that boxing all of this stuff up and shipping it is going to be both heavy and big in terms of the boxing. So I thought this was a nice pick.
Good choice. I agree. So my pick is something that I spotted a couple days ago and I thought might be gone by now, so I had bookmarked it just in case, and it's still there with no bids, and I don't get what people are seeing that I'm not seeing, because I don't see why this has no bids on it. I am selecting a still-sealed copy of VisiCalc, the PC version, so it's VisiCalc for DOS, for your Atari XT, or your IBM XT computer. So if you're
Atari
a collector, if you're a collector for old software, I mean, this is the, you know, a very popular edition of VisiCalc from 1982. It's still completely sealed, so it's, you know, highly collectible. You don't come across a lot of still sealed versions. And the opening bid is $40. It has a buy it now for $100, which itself I don't think is an outrageous price, but I'm really surprised that nobody has ponied up a single bid for $40. There's still five days left in this auction, but I'm really surprised that nobody, and I kept looking like, what are people seeing that I'm not seeing? Because it's a good seller. It's got 100% feedback with 60 things. It's not outrageous shipping. At least for me, it's $12.50. I don't know what it is to the US, but I think it's in good shape. It's still shrink wrapped. It looks to my eye like original shrink. You really have to watch shrink wrap stuff on the net because it's so easy to re-shrink wrap something. But this looks like original shrink.
Well, but look at the sticker on top of the shrink wrap.
Yeah.
That's hard to duplicate.
I think
too. You could do it, but I mean,
and it's shrunk in a way that seems period authentic, the way the shrink wrap would shrink. Like, to my eye, this looks authentic. It's $40. It's the, you know, it's not the original VisiCalc, go Apple.
Right.
It is, I think, in a lot of ways, a more useful version of VisiCalc. Like, it's so crazy that this thing has no bid. So anyway, I'm selecting this thing, and I think it's funny that nobody has ponied up $40 to buy this. I think it's a total steal for this.
I think the thing hurting it, if you will, is that it's not for the Apple II.
If you're collecting VisiCalc, then the collectible one, clearly. But you never see sealed copies for the Apple II. Like, and God knows what they would go for a heck of a lot more than $40. So if you're a PC collector and you like old software and you just, you know, some people collect that stuff. This is a major edition of a very important piece of software, still sealed from 1982, going for $40. Not a lot of software you can get that's this important. You can get still sealed for $40. So
and
I think it's a steal. Yeah,
I have it. I don't have all I have is the disc, but I have I have the functioning VisiCalc, this one, you know, for the PC.
But well, I believe that you can freely download it as well. I think Dan.
I mean, mine's the real thing, but I just don't have any of the packaging. The or
yeah, I mean, you get the packaging and plus the shrink wrap.
The
manual
and the shrink wrap.
I would buy it and I would de-shrink wrap it. I would defrog it.
I love doing that. I almost bought the thing. I don't even want the PC version, but I just love to open old software. I love it so much.
Get that old software smell.
Totally. Just adore it. So those are our three auction picks. Now, let's wrap things up with a bit of closing discussion. David, is it something to do with a museum? Are you starting another museum?
No, I'm not. I'm not starting a museum. I'm running a big computer show, though, sort of.
I've heard about that.
So actually, I wanted to mention.
I think I got something like 17 tweets about that. Actually,
some more VCFSE that rolls off the tongue, you know. News, and SE stands for Special Edition, by the way.
I pronounce it Vicky Views.
But after the show last time, I guess it was 2 or 3 days later. It must have been the Monday or Tuesday. I don't know. But anyway, I launched a Kickstarter campaign. This was something I'd been planning. And so we hit our goal just in a couple of days.
You're going to have a podcast soon that's not another Kickstarter campaign. You'll just keep doing them.
Well, and it's my Kickstarter. I mean, I'm running it, but it's not my Kickstarter.
And it's already been funded.
For the show. Yeah, so, yep. But, you know, the trick, so here's some advice, you know, when you run a, this is to me the most important advice, when you're going to run a Kickstarter, you want to you want to make your goal the lowest possible goal you can make where you can achieve what you need to do with it, you know, so you can meet it, so you can only go higher.
Some people say, you know, do that and then have stretch goals for more deliverables, but yeah, be as reasonable as you can, that's a good idea.
So the Kickstarter's still going. In fact, it's got 2 more weeks to go. We met the $800 goal. It's at $1,156 right now.
Can you still get in and get a T-shirt if you want to?
Oh, okay. Absolutely. Or a ticket. It's unlimited availability on that. You know, after this is done, then we'll order the T-shirts. So,
because I got to say, those were nice-looking T-shirts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah,
the green.
I'm very happy with them. Dan Roganti designed that for us, and he has done – it's funny. If you look in the Kickstarter, the picture of me, I'm wearing one of, you know, a VCF East T-shirt that he designed.
Oh, I hadn't spotted
VCF
that. Nice.
East from 2009, I think.
Nice.
So he designed that for us.
And what's the computer you're holding in your Kickstarter photo?
Oh, that is, I'm holding a board from the Altair that was built into a desk.
Oh, sure. Got it.
So that's, without zooming in on, I think this is a processor or it's RAM, something like that, one of the few boards.
Cool.
Anyway, so what you're doing, so the T-shirt, for us to make T-shirts, have some for sale and all, that presented a fairly large you know, amount of money we needed up front, about $1,000. So that's what I thought the Kickstarter would do, is help us fund that right off the bat. We can pre-sell some and afford to print enough and have them for the show too. And then we're also pre-selling some tickets. So it's a fundraiser to help us have enough money to run our side of things for the show. We're doing the whole exhibit hall with the tables, and people are going to pay for their exhibiting. But it's just, there's going to be lots of unforeseen things that we have to pay for. So this is making sure that we have the money to do all that stuff.
Very cool.
So you can still get in, get a T-shirt, or pre-buy a ticket. And that's it, really it.
And I saw Business Insider had a little article about you and
Yeah, so that just happened
museum.
This morning. And
the
so
museum
I went,
that just won't die.
Well, and what's funny about this is, so check out the article. It's amusing. It's called Apple Wouldn't Give Its Blessing, So Two Guys Built an Apple Museum on Their Own.
Yeah. That'll show them.
That's not exactly what's happening, and so that didn't come out of my mouth that way, but I still, and there's a picture of me, and there's a picture of Lonnie Mims, who's the big collector here in town, and he's the guy doing the Apple pop-up museum, which is the big major exhibit.
Which is a great
VCF.
Idea. I mean, honestly, as much as I make fun of it, that's a great idea to have at Vicky Fuse.
Yeah, so... so I emailed Lonnie this morning, go, look, I hope this won't upset you that this isn't exactly the, you know, but listen, no press is bad press, and it's kind of, you know, gets attention. That's the big
thing.
Well,
the media loves angst. I mean, they love the Sturm und Drang, you know, so that's why they would present it that way. You don't have a whole lot of control when you start talking to the media. They kind of, you know, do their own thing, but it's good that they're getting the word out there.
She's the editor of Business Insider. Julie Bort's her name. Real nice woman, and she's interviewed me before and done a couple things, like about my idea about Apple building a computer museum. I'll go ahead and use that term. But I just want to read something real quick. And but that was the angle that I presented to her. Hey, would you maybe cover this? And you could – so here, get to the email. This is the angle I had said – oh, here it is that – yeah, what about this humorous angle? You know, this guy's written articles stressing that Apple should consider building a visitor center and gallery of their history at the new Apple campus, too. They won't do it. But his friend, computer collector extraordinaire Lonnie Mims in the Atlanta area, said he'd build a whole Apple museum for the Vintage Computer Festival. So that was really my pitch to her. And so, you know, you can read it, the article. That's how it turned out.
And you know what? That's a good lesson for people out there trying to promote stuff. Like, I've done a lot of PR for various companies and that kind of stuff that my family's had, and also on behalf of other companies. And you have to give an angle, and you have to make it as easy as possible. It's crazy how many times people make the promotion to try to get somebody else to write about it more difficult than it needs to be. You've got to make it like news, not make it have an angle, and do as much as you can to sort of write it for them, and you will get people to pick up this stuff. People should take that to heart if you've got a product or an event or software of your own that you're looking to promote. David, you totally took the right approach this time.
and that's what a press release is for. And there was also some other coverage I was able to get right after the show 2 weeks ago, like around the 5th or something. And I sent out a bunch of press releases. And that's, you know, and in a lot of the cases, they're grabbing the stuff right out of the press release and just putting a little bit of extra stuff in there, you know, jazz it up some and publishing it.
Absolutely. So, that's how it's always done. Absolutely.
So
I think the next wave should be you guys should sue Apple over this.
Yeah.
Then you'll get some real press. So,
or
Earl, what about you? What have you got going on in Earl Land?
What am I doing? I had a flash thought that turned out to be a lot of fun. There's a local Commodore users group, and I called up the guy who runs it, Greg, and I said, hey, you know, why don't we do like a little session each time, each month, about a different programming language? And he thought, wow, that'd be fun. So we did our first one this last Thursday. We talked about a language called Oxford Pascal for the Commodore 64. This particular Pascal was interesting because it used the basic line editor, so you actually put in line numbers, but type Pascal instead of BASIC, and then run it, and it'd compile it and do its thing. And the thing that's interesting to me, if you're doing any project of consequence these days, programming for an 8-bit, you're probably going to write your program on a modern PC and then use some sort of cross-compiler or cross-assembler. But that wasn't the case back in the
80s. Like the CC65 or something like that.
Exactly.
Right.
But, I mean, back in the 80s, you probably didn't have a bigger computer. Maybe you did, but probably you didn't. You just had your 8-bit. So if you're going to program, you were going to use a language that was on the platform that you had. And I've always found them fascinating how the different language implementations kind of wrap themselves around the machine that they were running on, and what kind of editor you used and what features it had. And so I thought, gosh, we've got these to burn because there are probably dozens of these different languages. So
sure, totally.
We covered Oxford Pascal, like I said, this last Thursday. Next time, we're going to do Turbo Pascal for CPM, which runs on the Commodore 128 in its CPM mode. And I even found a library out there of some graphics routines that will let you run Commodore 128 graphics still while you're in the CPM mode on the Commodore 128.
Oh, cool. 128. Nice.
So, cool. Yeah, it's...
I don't have a lot of Turbo Pascal experience. I did a lot of Turbo C. But my Pascal experience, most of that was early Macintosh programming. I didn't really touch Pascal for the Apple II at all, and when it came out as an OS and a language. But I did a lot of early Macintosh programming and had the big white programming books, and so much of that was Pascal.
The,
so I did tons
inside,
of,
Macintosh,
inside Macintosh,
Macintosh,
yeah.
Right.
The big, want to learn to program? Here's 90 pounds of reading material.
I know,
so,
it was daunting.
Yeah. So I did a lot of Pascal, but all for early Mac was my Pascal, and really nothing outside of early Macintosh for Pascal.
Well, I love Pascal because it's the language that I used in college. I mean, it was so
I've
much
I've always been a big
than...
fan. I liked Pascal on the Mac. I thought it was a great operator. I really enjoyed programming in that.
It was better than BASIC for learning because it had real data structures and real pointers, and you could do linked lists. And
I learned a ton. There was a ton of programming techniques and programming ideas that I cut my teeth on with Pascal on the Mac. So I learned a lot about procedural stuff for the first time doing it on the Macintosh, and learned a lot about using libraries. All that kind of stuff was new to me when I became a Mac programmer. So
I got two questions.
Yeah,
I got four answers. So first, Earl. So Turbo, that was all Borland, right? Turbo Pascal and Turbo
Borland International. Another thing that I loved about the Borland products was first they were cheap, and the second is they had a really sensible license agreement. They said that you can treat this software like a book. So if you have three different computers that you have, you can load it and use it on all three as long as you're only using it in one place at once.
Just like
a book that you would, you know, do that. And so that was beautiful. No copy protection. The version that I'm talking about is on CPM, but I've also got Turbo Pascal 3.0 that I got off eBay for DOS. And it had some great graphics libraries and others. I always loved Turbo Pascal.
And then Carrington, have you ever heard of, if you did Pascal, I was never a programmer, but did you ever use TML Pascal on the Mac? You ever heard of that one, TML?
No, it doesn't even ring a bell.
I used to work for a company in Jacksonville, Florida, and they made TML Pascal, and it worked. I know, what was the other, the Macintosh work, or work box or something, or the programming box, or
Magnetronics Programmer Workshop or work.
Yeah, yes. That's it.
Yeah.
So I think it worked with that, but it was a product that the company made early.
Oh, sure,
on,
right, and yeah, and you could use that to develop a lot of things, including programs where MBW could be used for like working for the 2GS and stuff. So that's an
but
example
the guy,
of programming
it was named
one
after
computer for another.
The main programmer, Thomas Leonard, and I guess his middle initial was TML.
Okay.
Anyway, that's a whole
no,
other
but I'm,
story.
I'm
but...
totally not familiar with that. I mean, I did a lot of MPW stuff, absolutely. So that was the MPW shell I used quite a bit for different things. So, but TML doesn't ring a bell.
Okay.
Ah, that rhymes. So really interesting, Earl. That's a great idea. So what was the you're doing it for a users group, was it? What, just so people know, like what is the
PDX? It's the PDX Commodore users group, which you can find info at pdxcug.org.
Okay.
And I believe that some of the future sessions, they're actually going to make videos and we're going to put them online. So
oh, very nice. So people that aren't in the Portland area can still sort of get involved.
That's exactly the idea. So when we
fantastic.
Do that, I'll make sure to get a link up on our show notes of that.
Hey, Earl, they went to VCF Midwest. We think they'll come on down the Southeast VCF?
I don't know. Greg travels
across that country.
He travels around. I mean, there's a annual Commodore show called Convex that happens every year in July in Vegas, and that's a big
okay.
one for the Commodore world. So
oh,
I don't
cool.
know
that'd
if
cool.
you'd make it to the to your show, but that'd be fun.
Yeah.
Very nice. I think that about wraps. Oh, yeah, I was going to mention that I have launched a YouTube channel, Monster Feet TV, sort of the video video sister channel to the audio podcast I do at monsterfeet.com, mostly because I wanted to stick up a couple of videos. There's two shows launching soon that will really be just video playlists at the Monster Feet TV channel on YouTube. But I needed some content there, so I stuck up a quick video about the Fix of Felix Jr., because a lot of people were interested in that, so I threw up a video a couple days about that. And I have another video going up today where I open up and I filmed all the inside of it, so you can see how Disney put the system together. So that'll go up later
nice.
Today. And so that's just over at youtube.com/MonsterFeetTV, and we'll have a link in the show notes as well. So that's where you'll see launching in... It was supposed to be last November, but thanks to no quarter, it's been moved. So it looks like it'll be now first or second week of March will be 8-Bit Archaeology. And so that's the first of the two video shows I'm launching. So, but we'll have links. I'll talk about that when it finally does, 6 months late, actually launch. So we'll see. But not a lot of news. I've got some stuff for show and tell, but not a lot of other news going, other than I'm building another MAME cabinet, which will go between those two behind me. So that should
oh
be
my
up
gosh.
By
I'm
next
such
a,
I think you're
such a stand-up
you the
show.
You have the bug. You've been bit.
I have been bit. And mostly I just want to play some other games. And for no quarter, like it really motivates me to have a good machine that I can kick Mike's butt at. So my competitiveness has motivated me to build a great main
very
cabinet.
Good.
Nice, great action. Just so I can beat Mike.
In closing, if I can add. Just
yes, you
before...
can, pseudo-host.
Earlier, before the show, we walked over in our neighborhood because we've been renting ever since we moved here. So we're looking to buy a house this summer. So hopefully we'll be closing on a house and hopefully one with a basement where I no longer have to have stuff in the garage. I'll have like a nice work area in the basement. And I really want to buy a stand-up arcade machine. I mean, that would be a little later on.
Or build a MAME machine if you're only going to have one. MAME offers you to have a lot of games in just one space.
So I might be needing some of your advice.
I talked about this show or maybe on No Quarter. At Kansas Fest this summer, that's going to be my presentation.
Yeah.
We're going to be building a MAME computer or MAME system from scratch in 30 minutes. So we'll
I think
have
you
one
said
that
on No Quarter. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
cool.
So we'll be able to talk about that. So people at the show, if you're interested and you come down to Kansas Fest, I'll be there to sort of help people and show. We'll assemble one together that I can you'll give people advice on where you get stuff and how to wire it up and that kind of stuff, because it's way easier than it.
How are you
going to
get it out of Kansas Fest?
I'm going down by motorcycle, so how am I even going to get the parts down there? This is all stuff for me to work out later, whatever. I'm going to basically come down with boards and bits strapped to the back of my Harley as I drive down there. So we will see how much of that gets to Kansas. I'll work it out when I get there.
Yeah.
Might be a very ugly minimalist cabinet. So we'll see. So anyway, that brings us, I think, to the end of this show number 45. That's a wrap. Our next show will be coming up on Sunday, March 3rd. We do this every second Sunday. So remember, you can always join us live at 1 p.m. Pacific or 4 p.m. Eastern. You can find a link over at our website, which is rcrpodcast.com. And that's where you'll find links to the show notes, where you'll find links to the forum, ways to interact with us, send us email, all that kind of stuff. On Twitter, you can find us at rcrpodcast. And of course, you can always send feedback and audio files and whatever you'd like to get in touch with us by email at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And if you have a moment, we'd love it if you could review us on iTunes. That really helps us get great placement. And until next time, my fellows,
Retro Commute.
Thanks for joining us.
See you next time.